We're backstage with James Gaffigan. Bravo, that was a wonderful first half.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Gershwin is one of those composers where, and this particular program is one where you just smile a lot during that first half.
Yeah, I think the music of Gershwin is very audience-friendly for many reasons, and it's extremely American in that it celebrates jazz music and what I think we can call that music our own. But, of course, in the context of a concerto, which is a very serious word, a very serious type of composition, Gershwin really establishes name as a serious classical composer in this piece because he actually orchestrated it himself, which is very rare. Normally, people like Groffé or he would hire someone to do the orchestral parts, but in fact, he had his own vision for this particular piece.
And so talk a little bit about that. How does he use the orchestra?
Well, I think in a very fascinating way, the way he uses the percussion instruments, there are things like slapstick and xylophone and bass drum, snare drum, cymbals and timpani, of course. But the way he combines the instruments, like a backup band consisting of clarinets, two clarinets and a bass clarinet and a solo trumpet playing with a hat as a mute. And it's such a, it's like all of a sudden we're in a nightclub and it's an incredible effect.
And what draws you personally to Gershwin? How do you feel about him as a composer?
Well, I love this music for many reasons, but like I said before, the jazz element, I started off as a jazz musician. That was my first music. That was my first love, rock music and jazz music. And then I fell in love with classical music slightly later. Most of my colleagues start playing from a fetus, you know, playing the violin. But I think for in my world, it's very comfortable, these swinging rhythms and these syncopations and these dances. So I love it, and I think it's charming, and it's extremely high-quality music. I don't think any serious classical musician would argue that Gershwin is not a good composer.
Oh, no, it's really beautiful. And that first piece is not very well known.
No, it's so charming, but everyone recognizes it, the promenade, the walking the dog. It's really, it brings you to another time, another era.
And we're about to hear the Dvorak American Suite and the Barber First Symphony. Could you talk a little bit about the shape of this program and how you decided to put these pieces together?
Well, yeah. I mean, Dvorak, although he's a Czech composer, he was in love with America and he was in love with American culture and these kind of these Negro spirituals that he learned, and also the Native American, the Native Americans in general. He spent a lot of time around these people and was fascinated by the music of America, actually more than most American composers themselves. So in a way, Dvorak is one of the best American composers in kind of fantasy land speaking. But I think this particular piece, again, celebrates this music of early America, and it feels very American. There's a cakewalk in there. There's these Native American rhythms of zum, bum, 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 things like that. And it's at the highest orchestration level. I mean, every musician of the Philadelphia Orchestra is fascinated by this because they, I would say 90% of them don't know this piece when we started rehearsing it.
And it's so interesting because the audience probably coming from the same direction, everybody knows the New World Symphony.
Exactly.
And a lot of people don't know that he was writing a lot of pieces about America when he was here.
Well, yeah. I mean, the New World Symphony especially, but even the Cello Concerto and the Eighth Symphony and this particular piece, it really celebrates what he learned and what he loved about this country. And I love that. I feel all of those elements in the music. And of course, there are these Czech dances and Czech rhythms too that are celebrated in the piece. So I think it's a beautiful piece of music, and I think more people deserve to hear it.
Well, we're looking forward to it. With the Philadelphia Orchestra, is there a certain approach you take?
Yeah, I mean, with an orchestra at this level, with an orchestra that could play as well as the Philadelphia Orchestra does, we have the advantage of making these transparent sections extremely transparent, and these magical ghost-like dynamics that Dvorak writes on top of sometimes very aggressive rhythms, we could bring out in the best possible way. So I think we concentrated in the rehearsal period on lots of color elements and also making sure that when there's a transparent texture that you could hear all these sparkly orchestrations very clearly.
Can you point to any particular parts that we should listen for?
Yeah, I think within the Alla Polacca, this moderato, the third movement, in between this funny little silly cakewalk comes these little episodic moments that sometimes feature very few wind players. And then the strings join and enhance that experience. So something that starts off very intimate and selfless becomes extremely indulgent and romantic. And I love that. It's in a matter of seconds that he does that, all the while surrounding it by this charming cakewalk type music.
And so then we come to The Barber, his first symphony, his major work, only 4 years after he graduated from Curtis. Again, people are very familiar with Adagio for Strings, but don't always know the rest of Barber's repertoire. Can you talk a little bit about this work?
I would say this is a quintessential American symphony. This is as American as it gets. I would argue that the most successful and popular American symphonies are Ives Symphony No. 4, Copland Symphony No. 3, and Barber Symphony No. 1. I think for many reasons, this piece is a masterpiece that everyone should hear and everyone should experience. I've had to fight to program this piece, actually, even in America, because I think people think, oh, the audience doesn't know it. But I think the audience deserves to know it. So when we can attract the audience, like a program like this, to hear the Gershwin or to hear Jackie Parker play, they're going to be pleasantly surprised to hear the Barber Symphony, something that they wouldn't normally experience. But this piece plays like a great novel. I think of Grapes of Wrath of Steinbeck, or even East of Eden. Seeing this American landscape and this American tragedy of people working extremely hard and horrible things happen to them, and some of them are just in their DNA. It's going to happen whether they like it or not. There's a lot of tragic elements in this particular piece of music. And just like American culture, there's beauty to what's going on in our country, and then there's a lot of sadness and confusion. And I think we're still figuring it out as a country. And that's Barber. At the end of this piece, it's a very much a to-be-continued ending. It's tragic, and it's a big question mark. But it celebrates the working class, the working people, hard work in general. You feel the labor in this music. And it's very sad, and it's very human. And I think Barber is very underestimated as a composer. And I'm proud to bring this work to Philly. And I know they've performed it many times in the past. But I think it should be a real staple of the American repertoire.
So what is the story behind it?
I don't think it's fair to say a story, because Barber decided not to have a story behind it. And I think when a composer decides something is absolute music, for example, like a Beethoven, early Beethoven symphony, opposed to a Strauss tone poem with a specific plot and specific story, or Franz Liszt or Berlioz, I think in this case, we need to experience it through emotions. You're going to experience loneliness during the oboe solo. Mr. Woodhams, who's retiring this year, it's been a pleasure to work with him in his last year of professional work with the orchestra after decades of performing here. This particular moment is heart-wrenching. It's so beautiful and sad and lonely. And I don't know how he creates that. I guess that's the definition of a genius. When you look at the page and it's just notes on the page, there's nothing really special happening. But as soon as you hear it in the moment and when the score comes to life, you have a gut emotional response to it. And this piece has a lot of those emotional responses, and not just the loud, grandiose moments, but the intimate, quiet moments.
Are you interpreting it on the basis of what was going on in Barber's life at the time?
Definitely not. I don't think any composer's life really should play into their music. Of course, people like Gustav Mahler, there are so many tragic elements of his life that play in his symphonies. I don't think it's the same with Samuel Barber. I think the notes on the page are enough to tell the story. And I have my own storyline of the symphony, and I don't think it should be shared with anyone else. I think you can find your own interpretation. If you lost a loved one, that's what you might experience in the oboe solo. If you've had someone leave you and you've had a relationship end, you might experience that in the oboe solo. I mean, there are countless things you can experience in that moment of the piece, in the slow movement, the third movement. It's in one movement, the symphony, but this is the third part I'm referring to. But yeah, and the opening sounds like the beginning of an incredible film score or something. It's very much like the world of Korngold and things like this. And I love it. I see Wagner in the score. There's Sibelius in the score. These open, wide landscapes, frigid land or barren land, whatever you want to picture. It's all in the music, and it's all up to your fantasy and being open to this music and experiencing it in the moment like a child with childlike enthusiasm.
Well, it's interesting because Dvorak was a Czech writing about America in New York City, and Barber was an American writing in Europe. And you're now at Lucerne. You grew up in New York, is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. I grew up in New York City, and And I've been living in Lucerne for the last eight, nine years. And yeah, I mean, I love living in Europe, but I always miss home. I miss New York City, and I miss places like Chicago and Philly and LA and San Francisco. So I think I have a nice balance in my life where I spend half the time in Europe and half the time in the States. And I think I need that balance. I can't do one or the other because I adore European lifestyle. You know, when I first moved to Europe, I couldn't sit and have a coffee. I always took a coffee to go. That was all I knew, or taking a slice of pizza to go. And the idea of sitting there and actually this cafe mentality, which is showing up more and more in the States and in big cities like Philly and New York. And I've learned a lot about music in Europe, things that you can't necessarily learn in the States.
Are there certain expectations when you're conducting an orchestra in Europe, certain traditions that you tap into?
Well, yeah, the rehearsal process is completely different in the sense that American orchestras, they show up much more prepared for that first rehearsal. Yet it's hard to get them going to a higher level unless the chemistry is really right for the conductor and the orchestra. Whereas in Europe, they start at a kind of sight reading low level, but the projection, the process is so big from beginning to end, it improves so much. And I think there's more of a focus on phrasing in Europe than ensemble. And America is very much being together and playing together, which I think both are important. So I think I'm very lucky to have both worlds in my mind at all time. And I try to keep a balance between the American priorities and the European priorities.
You said that you started out in music as a jazz musician.
Jazz rock music, yeah.
What were you playing?
Guitar, yeah. So, I mean, for me, you know, I loved popular music, and I loved jazz. Also in school, we were playing a lot of Ellington and things like big band stuff. And I adored this world of improvisation and the freedom of improvisation, but having strict guidelines to that improvisation. That's, I think I keep that rule in my life with classical music, that not to be too square, or, you know, because what's on the page is there's only so much information, and then you have the freedom to do other things with that information.
Great. Thank you so much, James Gaffigan. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
It's a pleasure for me. It's so great to be back with this orchestra.
Everything you hear on WRTI is made possible by members. Please join today.